Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our guest today is Spajmay Aksir. She's part of the steering committee for Afghans for Peace at AfghansForPeace.org. Spajmay is living in Canada right now, and she's preparing for her doctorate. She's the author of a book, So Far Away, Voices of Rural Women of Afghanistan. Spajmay, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. First of all, I introduced you and told my listeners that you are on the steering committee for Afghans for Peace. Can you tell my listeners what Afghans for Peace is?
Okay, sure. So Afghans for Peace is an organization that members are of various different ethnic, religious, linguistic, geographic locations, but we all identify ourselves as Afghans. And we basically have a common vision, which is to see peace and stability in Afghanistan. And our mission is to help mobilize Afghans worldwide, whether they're inside or abroad, to take a firm stance against war and occupation in Afghanistan and to demand that Afghan people be allowed the right to self-determination. And to achieve our vision, we call for an end to war and occupation, violent and extremist groups, Islamophobia, racism. And we also want a truth, reconciliation and justice process, reparations, humane governance, sustainable development, and sovereignty for Afghanistan.
Well, right on. That sounds like a good organization to support and some worthy goals. Does Afghans for Peace represent the voices of the majority of people in Afghanistan in the rural and the city areas?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I'm going to base the answer on that, on my experiences of visiting the country since 2004. I've been there a number of times, and I've talked to people both in the countryside and in the cities, and they're very much tired of what's happening right now. They're tired of, you know, all these foreigners coming to the country and very little development actually taking place.
Uh-huh.
And we hear them. Our members are we're all diverse. We have very different backgrounds. We represent different linguistic groups, religious groups. So I believe we do represent the voice of the majority in that we want peace. And we also recognize, along with many Afghans, there was a recent poll that showed that most Afghans are actually against the invasion. They don't think the situation has improved. So I would say that, yes, we do represent the voices of the majority in that we want peace in Afghanistan and we want this occupation to end.
Before we go on, how can the peace movement in the U.S. and Canada be how can we work with you better? How can we incorporate the voices of the people of Afghanistan in what the people of Afghanistan want? What can we do in America and Canada to help your organization out?
Well, Cindy, I think you're doing it with this program. You know, you're letting people like us on your show. It's really difficult, both in Afghanistan and outside of Afghanistan, to speak against, you know, the government, or especially these occupying forces who work in collaboration with the government. It's more difficult to take a stance against them than in support of them. So people like Afghans for Peace, you know, we constantly struggle on a daily basis, everywhere, you know, voicing, you know, telling people the truth. So having a program like yours, this is exactly what we need. We need these kinds of platforms where we can come and we can share our experiences. You know, some of us have been to Afghanistan, so we know firsthand what's going on. This is a beginning. This is a good place to start. And I would say more education is still needed in regards to what we've actually accomplished. I think the mainstream media generally tends to be very positive about our accomplishments. But I think they need to be positive in order to continue gaining support for the war.
Uh-huh.
When in reality, unfortunately, things have worsened. And, you know, in my own research, I come across a lot that focuses on women and how the situation for women has deteriorated in the last 10 years. It was horrible to begin with, but it has worsened since we've been there. So definitely we need to ask questions about what's going on, how our money is being spent, and, you know, whether these accomplishments are real or if they're just sold to us so that we can continue supporting the war.
Well, and that's another excellent point that you brought up, because here in the United States, to many people who were in the anti-war movement when George Bush was president, all of a sudden the occupation of Afghanistan became somewhat acceptable to them because we have a democratic president. And many people who were in the anti-war movement and who were against the occupations when George Bush was president will tell me now, I mean, straight to my face, yeah, and some organizations here in the U.S., that we have to stay, the U.S. has to stay, the U.S. and the or NATO has to stay in Afghanistan to protect the women.
Yeah.
Are you saying that that's not your experience when you actually are in Afghanistan?
Correct. You know, I find this even here in Canada that it's really difficult to, well, I think it's becoming more acceptable now. I think the general public is starting to realize that this is a war that is failing for sure. And you brought up a good point about the woman. You know, one of the main pillars or justifications for this war was using the rhetoric of rescuing Afghan women, of giving them freedom because they were being oppressed. And, you know, that was used to justify the invasion into the country. And it's a narrative that we continue to hear quite often. But sadly, you know, Afghan women do suffer. Like many women in many parts of the world, they suffer as well. But their suffering is, you know, 10 times worse because the country is so devastated by decades of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
However, what has happened is people have exploited them completely by, you know, talking about their oppression, but not actually listening to them and, you know, doing what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we're going in with what we think they want. But this is so silly. You know, it's so silly when I'm there and I see this happening, all this money being wasted. And you would think, well, you know, people are actually interested in helping these women. Well, no, not really. Not if you see what actually has been accomplished so far, which is very little. And the way that women have been presented as this, you know, homogenized, victimized group, it's only been done, sadly, to sell the war, not to actually help the woman. So like I said earlier, the situation of women has actually worsened. It has not improved in the last 10 years.
Well, you were born in Afghanistan, according to my information.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're now living in Canada, and how old were you when you moved from Afghanistan to Canada?
I left Afghanistan. I lived, most Afghans fled during the Soviet war, and I was born during that time. So I fled to Pakistan with my family in the 1980s, early 80s, and came to Canada in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in Afghanistan, I think, until the age of 4. I think I was around 4 years old. But then moved to Pakistan and went back and forth because where we live in Afghanistan, it's very close to the Pakistani border. So,
right,
you know, within 2 hours, you can be in Afghanistan or you can be in Pakistan. But I've been in Canada for over 20 years, about 22 years. And I'm sorry, what was the question there? I missed.
I just wanted to know how long you were in Afghanistan,
yeah,
and when you moved to Canada. But do you, and you go back to Afghanistan, you said you've been going back since 2004. What are the differences that you notice?
Yeah, you know, I wish I could say that life was better before and now it's worse.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is that because I was kind of born in the era of the Soviet occupation, at that time, just as I was coming aware of, you know, the world around me, I guess, war was unfolding. So I spent my childhood running away from bombs, helping family move, looking after family when they would escape their homes and come and live with us in Pakistan. So my childhood experiences have been of war.
Mm-hmm.
They've been of displacement. They've been of poverty, They've been of losing family members, losing, you know, I could go on. It's just, but the sad news that I experience when I visit now is that I thought, you know, prior to 2001, I thought, well, that the nightmare was over. Now it was just a matter of, you know, helping to rebuild our lives.
Right.
But in 2001, what happened was, you know, the same thing can be, like, now there's another war. Why is there a war? But it's a different kind of war, you know. It's a justified war, which makes it worse. And, you know, I live in Canada, and I cannot deny, you know, the opportunities that this country has given me. I mean, I love living here. I'm a proud Canadian. And what hurts me now more is, and I think a lot of Americans probably, American Afghans probably feel the same way, is that, you know, we call this country our home too. And now our home, our current home, is invading our childhood home. So it's like, I feel like we're you know, being victimized twice, you know, all over again. And Afghanistan, when I left it, when I came to Canada, it was in a shattered state. I mean, there was very little happening. There was very little survival in terms of infrastructure. And to actually have war going on now on a country that's already so devastated, so broken, it really, I don't know what to make of it. I think it's beyond tragic.
When you say earlier in your answer, you said that the difference between the Soviet war and this war now is that this war is justified. Did you mean that this war is justified in many people's minds because of 9/11?
Yes.
Oh, okay, but it's not really literally, legally or morally justified.
Absolutely. This war is seen as a saving mission, as a development mission. It's seen in all these, you know, these peaceful terms when it's not, that's not what it is. And I think that's what makes it really difficult for, you know, people like members of the Afghan for Peace. It makes it even more challenging for us to be fighting against the war because so many around us are still not aware. They don't know, they don't understand the reality of what's actually happening. You know, or maybe they don't have the time to actually understand, or maybe they don't care, or you know, sometimes it's really hard to deconstruct everything around you when, you know, the television is telling you the same thing, newspapers are replicating the same stories. It's really difficult to have that critical mind, I understand. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't. I mean, I definitely think that we need to continue being very critical of what we're being told by the mainstream media.
Oh, of course. Do you still have family in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think over 80% and 90% of my family is in Afghanistan. Everybody's still there. So, you know, and a lot of them live in the countryside. Some live in the cities, but many of them live in the countryside. So when I go back, I tend to divide my time between staying with them in the villages and then also staying in the cities. So, yeah, I mean, what's going on is actually affecting us very close to home. It's not something that, you know, I can sit back and ignore. I can't. I actually have family there that's affected.
Do you, when you're in Afghanistan, are you afraid of the occupational forces?
This is something I never prepared myself for, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went back to Afghanistan, the first time I went was in 2004, and I was just amazed at how afraid I was of the military. There are rules, you know. The military has rules within the country, and you know your country is occupied when all you see is tanks everywhere, and when you sleep, you hear airplanes, you know, flying over you. Like, it's so bizarre. You know you're in a war zone. But some of the rules that they've invented, they have, the NATO forces include, you're not allowed to take pictures if they're around. If they're driving, you have to pull to the side of the road. You cannot drive when they're driving through. You have to wait until they're completely out of sight before you can move. You cannot take pictures. When I was in the eastern part of Afghanistan, I saw a sign on a road. On just a normal road, you know, that everybody would take, there was a big sign that said, you know, do not take pictures here. This is very, very alien to me. This is, you know, it's not something we Afghans do. So I felt very fearful because, for me, I'm not used to military as well. I didn't grow up You know, with soldiers in my yard every day. I know my family has, but I was fortunate enough to live in Pakistan during the Soviet war. So when I go back and I see the military presence, it terrifies me. Whereas I find my relatives, they're afraid of it, definitely. They feel intimidated, but they're used to it because they compare the soldiers to the Soviet times. It's not uncommon for them to do that. So I feel like they're used to it, but that doesn't mean they like it. They mm-hmm. still hate it, and they mm-hmm. still wish they weren't there. But I think they have a better coping mechanism than I do, because I freaked out when I would see them and we had to pull over. I had to hide my camera. I had to make sure I didn't move in the car. I was afraid. Mm-hmm. I would draw attention to myself, like, just horrified. But they would remain calm, and they knew the procedures better than I did, I guess. So. Yeah, so I personally felt a great sense of fear, and I just returned 2 months ago, and I was in the eastern part again, and again we had to pull over because the military was going through in their tanks, and we had to pull over, and you're not allowed to move. It doesn't matter where you have to go or if you're in a hurry, too bad. You have to pull over until they're through, you know, and we had to make sure we didn't move in the car. So very terrifying, I have to say.
Kind of reminds me of the situation in Israel between the Israelis and the Palestinians, where, you know, at their checkpoints and you know, things like that. If a woman's getting ready to have a baby, it doesn't matter.
Or
if somebody's having a heart attack and needs to get to the hospital, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Oh, that's just
Cindy. When I was actually leaving from Kabul to my village, it's about a 3-hour ride in the car. It was a cold, wintry night. This was in 2009, beginning of 2009. And we were pulled over in the middle of the mountains. Those of you that have been, you know, people who have been to Kabul know how difficult that road is. It's like you have to go through the mountains. There's nothing there, just mm-hmm. mountains. And we had to pull over because these military trucks had to go by. I think we were stopped for 2 hours in cold weather. It was snowing. We didn't have a heater in the car. Uh-huh. I had to go to the bathroom, couldn't uh-huh. do that. And we were just there. And men were getting impatient. And, you know, there were a lot of men who would come out of their cars and they would start swearing. They'd be like, what the hell? You know, we need to go. Too bad. They couldn't do anything. And then the translators would come from the military. And they would, you know, try to calm people down and say, look, don't do anything. You know, they're going to go and then you can move. Very, very terrifying. That was a very scarring experience for me.
That's just, to me, that's just unconscionable to treat human beings like that. But this is a little bit off the subject, but it's not entirely off the subject. You lived in Pakistan for quite a while, and now it seems like the bombings, especially using unmanned aerial vehicles in Pakistan and the border regions around Afghanistan, Pakistan, it seems to be having a real destabilizing effect on the entire country, because many people in Pakistan see that and think that and believe that, rightfully so, that the Pakistani government or military is working with the U.S. to target, you know, these people in Pakistan, the Pakistan-Afghanistan region. Do you have any experience with that? Do you know any of your relatives
or
friends?
Yeah, very little. When I stayed in Pakistan, even when I was there 2 months ago, I actually stayed close to the Afghan-Pakistani border. And the tension, you know, a lot of these things that happen, they don't necessarily happen in the area where I was living, but, I mean, an hour away from there, definitely. That province, that area, a lot of Afghan refugees live there. So mm-hmm. A year ago, there were a few suicide attacks and so on, but the locals have definitely realized that peace in that region, in that particular area, has completely deteriorated because of Pakistan's alliance with the Americans and what they're doing. And a lot of the attacks, it's interesting, a lot of the suicide attacks that happened, people would tell me that they didn't think it was, suicide. They wouldn't call it suicide attack. They said, oh, it's probably the Pakistani government. They want money from the state, so they're probably doing this themselves. Nobody I talked to or people that talked to me about those things that were happening those incidences, they blamed it on the government. They didn't blame it on, you know, insurgents or Taliban or whatever. They said, no, the government is just trying to squeeze more money out of the states, and they're probably doing this themselves. I found that very interesting. I mean, I don't have any evidence to base that on, but that is what the people were telling me. And, yeah, that area, I was in that area as a child as well. And, yeah, it's deteriorated. I was there actually 5 years in 2004 as well. And comparing it to now, it's worse now than it was in 2004. There's more attacks of, you know, these kinds of suicide attacks, and these unrests are happening more now than they were when I was there, or from what I was hearing from my family living in that area a few years ago. So, yeah, it's definitely happening. But then again, the area that I was in was about an hour or 2 hours away from where the real unrest is, which is, I think, in the Swat Waziristan, which is a bit further north. I don't know too much about that area, unfortunately, but it's definitely affected the area where I was staying.
According to my records or what I have in front of me, you're getting your doctorate in Canada. What are you getting your doctorate in, and what's the reason you're doing it?
Yeah, well, I hope my reason is justified, but I'm doing a doctorate in education in post-conflict context. So I focus on Afghanistan, and I focus quite a bit on gender. And I think the reason I do that is because I have very strong connections to Afghanistan myself, and being female and having female relatives that live both in the city and in the countryside, I feel there's quite a lot of misunderstanding of who Afghan women really are, what they want, what they need. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. So I am trying, I'm hoping that through my research I can help try to deconstruct that a little bit and kind of look at women in a very, contextualize them a little bit and look at them not as a homogenized group, but as individuals who are affected by various factors. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that I can contribute towards towards the betterment of the lives of women, particularly in the area of education.
Based on your observations and being an educated person, you know, that gets your news outside of the mainstream media also and from experience. Yeah. Do you think that the United States is going to be leaving Afghanistan alone anytime soon?
I think there are two sides to this war. One is, you know, convincing kind of the American public that this is justified and they went in there to bring peace and stability to the region, and they're trying to accomplish that, you know, because they, after all, that is what they told the people of America, but as well as everybody else, that that's what they were going in for. So there's that, and then there's the other part is the fact that a lot of people are, I don't want to say benefiting from the war, but their jobs are definitely dependent on the war. So whether it's setting up NGOs or, you know, setting up businesses or whatever, there is an economic side to this war, too. I can see that the military side of things are failing, and I think people are becoming aware of this, and I think probably the military itself is becoming aware of it. But I don't know if they can just leave, because there are many advantages to being in Afghanistan economically. You know, there's a lot of reconstruction companies that have opened up. There's all kinds of NGOs. There's all kinds of avenues where you can really make money. And it's not just, you know, foreigners who are doing this. There's a lot of Afghan expatriates or Afghan elites who are also benefiting quite greatly from this war. So I don't see those people, especially since they also tend to have a lot of power, I don't see them saying, you know what, we don't have peace, let's get rid of the military. I think they're going to want the military there because it's benefiting them, if I'm making sense. So I don't know. It's going to be tough. I think I can see the military leaving, but I think there's always going to be a presence of foreign involvement. And it's going to include not just Americans, but it's going to include many other powerful people with a lot of power and money who are going to want to continue benefiting from the, who benefit actually from the poverty of the, the vast majority, if that makes sense.
And then also Afghanistan is very wealthy in minerals and precious stones and things like that too.
Yeah, and, you know, and there's that side of it as well. And, like, my research, you know, I focus mostly on education, and when I go back, I look for things that are related to education. And some of the things I notice are, for example, you know, the building of schools. People come, they build schools, they, you know, their project, they go back and they tell their bosses, I guess, that, you know, yeah, we went, we built a school, we're done, right? Mission accomplished. But what happens is the school is usually built, but it's not used. I visited schools that were built and were not being used by locals because it was not possible to use them. I went to a an area that's about 45 minutes from Kabul, and there's a beautiful building, beautiful, gorgeous school that's been built for the local people, but no one can actually use it because the temperatures are like minus 10 in that region. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's no electricity. There's no water. There's no desk. There's no material. There's no teachers. So how are you going to use the school? Well, you can't. So the person who's in charge of that area, he uses it as his office, you know. And there's many incidences like that where schools have been built, but they're not being used. Or they're built, but they're not built in according to the needs of the local people. So, for example, if they ask for a girl's school, they get a boy's school. Well, they don't want that. Or they want a boy's school. They don't want it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't actually ever meet local needs. It's very... It's not very, I wish it happened more, but I think it's not happening as much.
Well, and the contractor doesn't care if it's built to specifications for the Afghan people because they're getting paid for it anyway.
Well, they're getting paid
for
it.
They could care less if anybody uses it.
One of the other trends that's happening now is, you know, contractors from here are, you know, there's local contractors as well. So they deal with the local Afghan contractors. And then what the Afghan contractors do is they buy the cheapest material you can imagine, and they don't complete the project either, not 100%. Like, I know one guy who is a contractor, and he has built half a road, and it's been 2 years, and he's only built. So the road literally leads to the middle of nowhere. It just stops in the middle of a mountain because he hasn't finished the construction because nobody's going back to check up on him. And, you know, the material that's been used to build these roads is very cheap. So within a year, things start to deteriorate, a year or 2 years. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of corruption that's taking place, and there's no sense of accountability, and you really don't know who to blame.
Well, I know who to blame. The profiteers, the war profiteers.
And they wouldn't say it, but I don't think they would say that they are to blame. I mean, it's so easy. Like, it's so easy for us to see this, but when you're down there, like, it's, you know, no one is ever held accountable because one person blames another. The local contractor will blame his boss, and his boss will say, well, that company is not in Afghanistan anymore. So, you know, in the end, no one is ever held accountable, and money is laundered, and, you know, you don't know what happened.
Right. We're running out of time, Spajmai. What do you have anything else you'd like my listeners to know?
Well, okay, so, you know, like we were saying earlier, talking about the war, you know, it's very difficult work. And one of the challenges that I find when I talk about, you know, NATO and sort of take a very anti-war position, I find when I talk to my American friends that they feel a bit defensive, as if, you know, they feel guilty, I guess. And, you know, I hope that your listeners are not a part of that group. You know, this war, it's not about the American citizens. I think Americans generally care, Canadians as well, everybody. I mean, I think the general public generally cares about the people of Afghanistan. It cares about Afghanistan. And we know that because they're consenting to, you know, giving away their hard-earned money to be spent in this country. So I want people to know that the people of Afghanistan have nothing negative to say about Americans. I know that from my experience of spending time in villages with people. That, you know, they just want to live their lives. They have no agenda to hurt anybody, as it's often portrayed here in the West.
Right.
And what they want is, you know, they want opportunities to work. They want, you know, a better life, and they're not getting that. And unfortunately, the money that we're sending overseas that's so hard for us to make here in this country and that we need so desperately in our own backyards is not going to the people that we think it's going to. And we really need to start looking into where this money is going. And we cannot be passive about it because our passiveness, you know, is kind of becomes responsible for other people's oppressions, if that makes sense. So yeah. I think we need to ask our governments questions about what's actually happening and really be critical of whether or not we're accomplishing the goals that we want accomplished with our efforts.
Before we go, I want you to tell your website, give your website for my listeners. And, of course, we'll post it on my website so everybody can link, we have a link to your work and find out how to help your work. But last July, I just want to tell you a quick story. Last July, I was protesting in front of the White House, and President Obama was having meetings with, we were told, leading Afghan citizens, and the people that came out of the White House after the meeting were dressed very expensively with a lot of jewels and fancy expensive clothes. Yeah. And they came up to me because they had heard of who I was, and they came up to me and through a translator told me that, you know, they're sorry that our young people, our troops are dying in Afghanistan, but the troops need to stay there to protect the people of Afghanistan. What's your response to that?
Well, I would have asked, protect the people or protect your wealth?
Well, yes.
One of the biggest challenges that we face right now, Afghans for Peace as well, I'm talking about Afghans for Peace, is we have to deal with these Afghan elites who are making things worse. And they're sort of the people that always speak on behalf of Afghan people. Like, I had a woman who, you know, was talking about the needs of Afghan women, but she said something about, you know, these women want to work, they want to have an education, they want to have a job. And I asked her a question. I said, well, 85% of the people live in the countryside. They don't even have electricity. You know, they've never left their homes. What kind of work do they want?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, maybe they don't want work. Maybe they want something else. You know? And she's like, oh, how dare you say that? And she got very offended that I would say that they didn't want employment. I mean, she's right. There are women in Afghanistan in maybe the urban places who would want that, but definitely not the vast majority. So when you deal with these issues, you have to really fight with the Afghan elites because it's very hard to get through them. And many, many, many of them are benefiting from this war. And I think anybody who supports the military, any Afghan, I've come to this generalization, although I shouldn't be generalizing, mm-hmm. but I've come to see a pattern, and that is that people that defend the military are people who are actually benefiting financially
right.
from the war.
And the same situation in Iraq, too, that you described as the process of what's happening in Afghanistan. So, Spajmai, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your wisdom with Cindy Sheehan Soapbox today. And can you tell us your website?
Thank you for having me, Cindy, and thank you to your listeners for taking the time to listen to this wonderful program. The website is www.afghansforpeace.org, and all our information is there. Our contacts are there. So if anybody is interested in learning more, if they want information, or if they have questions, we especially welcome questions from, you know, from the American people, from anybody about the invasion, about this war, about anything about us. Please feel free to email us, and we always get emails, and we always take the time to respond to them. So please get in touch with us if you have any comments or any questions for us. And
thank you,
Cindy, for having me.
Oh, thank you, Spajmai Aksir. Thank you for your courageous work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Talk to you later. That was our guest, Spajmai Aksir from Afghans for Peace. I'd like to thank you for listening to another edition of Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'd like to thank, as always, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, our very courageous and special guest, Spajmai Aksir. And I hope you tune in next week when our guest will be Larry Pinkney. He's returning to the show to evaluate the second year of the Obama administration. He was on right after Obama was
inaugurated. Then he was on again after the first year. And we'll have Brother Larry Pinckney from Black Commentator on again next week. So tune in again next week.
You can take that to the bank.
I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
I must make my witness. Have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.